This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Season 4, Episode 13, Part 2 of Resolve Mysteries. If you did not listen to Part 1, go back. It was out last week. And this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. Happy spooky season!
Woo! 2 out of 3 love spooky season.
2 out of 3 spooksters here.
1 out of 3 Christmas only. So, 1 out of 3 get me right past spooky
it's
season.
It's not either or. You can enjoy both.
To me, it feels
either
or.
Well, I'm Carlin, and I'm a spookster.
I'm Allison, and I'm a spookster and a Christmaser.
I'm Eliza, and I don't like spooky things. I don't like.
She does love a good Christmas.
And I don't like black and orange. They're bad colors.
Yeah, I don't like orange either. But I can still get over it to love somebody.
I like dressing up. I like to dress up. I mean, we might get sucked into being like the butterfly life cycle for our stupid costume because our kids want to be butterflies.
So. Our daughters want to be butterflies, and now...
Butterfly life cycle. So somebody's a worm is what you're telling me.
Yeah. Eliza's a pupa, basically.
I'm a pupa.
My daughter told me that I could be a moth, a brown moth, nice. If I wanted to.
Mothman prophecies.
Yes, Mothman.
Oh, maybe I'll go as Mothman.
So many people have gone as Mothman since... MFM did the
oh, album. I forgot about that.
Yeah, but they don't have their kid dressed as a butterfly while they're doing it.
True. Anyway.
Okay, anyway, welcome to our show. As most of you know, for every review that you guys write, we donate $1 to a different organization, and this month's organization is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, suggested by our patron, Matthew.
Thanks, Matthew.
If you'd like to support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, and goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast.
Do it.
Okay. What is happening in part 2 today?
Well, as I have said so many times in a row today, I have a wanted segment about Todd Mueller, and it might not be his name.
And then I have a lost love segment about Heath Brian Vess.
Okay, let's tell some stories.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, we haven't had a good Connie in a while.
We haven't.
Connie is a name, and every time you're confusing
me.
Well, we had Liza Montgomery, but
that's true.
It was pretty brief.
So, we start out with a con man in Hawaii. Mm. A Hawaiian con. So, Stack tells us that a man arrived at a local bank on Maui and introduced himself as Pepito Dabayan. The reenactor we see explains that he has been named representative to his aunt's estate and hands over the paperwork to the bank manager. He wants to have her money transferred to a new account in his name, along with depositing a $15,000 check that he's written. And he says he wants to send $20,000 to an associate in Honolulu. The bank manager is a little bit suspicious about all of this. And so he says, okay, it's going to take a little bit to do all of this. Can you come back in an hour? And Pepito says, sure. And when he comes back, he's arrested for suspicion of forgery for the check he tried to deposit. So the Maui police at first could not tell who they had in custody because he had 15 different identification cards, all with different names on him.
Oh my God.
I love it.
But eventually they identified him as Todd Mueller.
I'm picturing like those binders that you use for baseball cards. He opens one of those up instead of his
They're
wallet.
Just flipping through.
Yes. And this was in August of 1990. Then he is released on bail. Big mistake. At least he's not dangerous, I guess, so far.
Yeah,
but this guy is going to try and trick and swindle anything he can, so don't let him out on bail.
Yeah.
But he's out on bail 3 months later, and on December 3rd, he showed up at a bank in Honolulu under the alias Arthur Iona. He told the employee that he was named the personal representative of the estate of a man named George McLaughlin, and he wanted to take the funds from George's account and place them in a new checking account in his name, just like he had tried to do with his quote-unquote aunt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this bank, this guy is wearing a tuxedo.
What? Yes. Oh, no. I was multitasking
while
I watched this.
A bow tie.
He is wearing a full-blown tuxedo.
And the ugliest baseball hat I've ever seen. It is so weird.
It's the weirdest outfit ever.
We'll post
strange.
A picture.
Yeah.
So, this bank manager is also suspicious of this man.
Dressed like a buffoon.
Because of what he looks like.
I would be suspicious as well.
Yeah.
Same, same.
And he is arrested again. So by this time, they're starting to understand that Todd Mueller's not going to stop doing this. And they also are trying to figure out what his con is. So they realize that he goes into newspapers and looks at the obituaries and, like we were just talking about the last episode, the probate court announcements, and takes names from there to place on the court documents that he's forging.
Oh.
He would then use whiteout and typewriters and copy machines. And the copy machines he used were actually at the circuit court building to forge the documents.
My God.
So he's like really is trying to find real people's names, probate court stuff, all of that to make it as realistic as possible. The documents would name him as executor to that person's estate, and the fake documents and checks allowed him to steal thousands of dollars from banks throughout Hawaii. This says banks. But technically, he is also stealing from the people's estates because he'd find where their accounts were held and stuff, which is unfortunate. I wish it could be
just
victimless.
Banks.
Just banks. Yeah, we'd be fine with that.
I think more people should steal from banks, honestly.
Let's go
They've been stealing from us since the beginning of time.
Look out. Carlin's going to start keeping money in her mattress and everywhere.
Watch out.
Because it runs in the family.
It sure does.
Okay. They show him wearing a tank top, smoking a cigarette, using that whiteout, forge. And then Stack says that some of his work was less than perfect. So then we hear about one of the checks that he tried to forge was from the Bank of Boise, Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, does not exist. And that is another way that a bank manager found him out was that, obviously,
he should have taken some of that stolen money and bought himself a map.
Yes. He obviously meant to say Boise, Idaho, but he didn't know that Boise, Iowa wasn't real. Or he thought it was Iowa instead of Idaho. It's an understandable mistake. We live very close to it.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, maybe depending on where you live.
Yeah. I don't know if I would have known.
But Boise is a pretty well-known city, so.
Yeah, probably. He also made suspicious moves because he got greedy, as they always do. And he would withdraw at one point $31,000 at a time from an account he opened in Honolulu.
Not sneaky.
At that point, the bank manager contacted the police, believing that the probate documents were false, and the detective knew right away that it must be Todd. So once again, Mueller was arrested. However, again, he posted bail and was released.
Guys.
Then finally, investigator Henry Nobrega attempted to get a search warrant for Mueller's home because he had gone there and, like, seen stuff in the windows, including his tuxedo hanging up. And was like, all right, this is it. We have to go get a search warrant. And he's, like, trying also and is also like, the next time that this guy is arrested, we are not letting him go.
The next time.
So,
third time's the charm, Hawaii.
Uh-huh. So, then Mueller himself called investigator Nobrega and said, don't worry about getting a warrant. I will just let you come in the house and look for whatever you want. So, Nobrega agrees to this, arrives at the home that weekend, and all of Mueller's possessions are gone, and of course, so is he. And neighbor said that he moved out in a hurry just about an hour before Mueller got there.
Oh, shit.
And he didn't obtain the search warrant, so, like, he couldn't go in. Because he believed this guy.
Why?
Well, he's convincing. He's a con man.
So then, a week after that, at the Oahu Corrections Facility, Todd Mueller's former cellmate, Roy Hartsock, is called, and he comes out, and one of the officers is like, Hartsock, you're being paroled. And Roy Hartsock is like, no, I'm not supposed to be paroled until February. And the guy's like, I don't know, I have a document right here. You're getting out. You're supposed to be out on immediate release. So Hartsock's like, okay, I guess I'll go. And 3 weeks later, investigators discovered that Mueller had forged the release documents for his cellie, which, what a nice guy, honestly.
Totally nice. Cellie. And what an honest bud.
Oh, I know. He's an, like, honest, no, guys, sweetie. It's honey, we're going to come back to Hartsock. Don't worry. So Mueller also pretended to be a New York police officer, calling investigator Nobrega, who's the same guy that he said, hey, just come on over to my apartment and I'll let you look around. And he claimed that the officers had a guy there named Todd Mueller, but it's him acting as a police officer. In reality, Mueller was staying at an expensive hotel in Chicago. So hotel employees...
This is like Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
It's crazy.
It's like Matthew Broderick getting his girlfriend out of school.
Yes.
Them going to a fancy restaurant.
Yeah. Red herrings. Just, yep.
And pulling the wool over the same person's eyes more than once.
Over and over again.
Oh my God.
So hotel employees are kind of watching him because he's been in this hotel for a while. And they notice him meeting people in the lobby and trading large amounts of money with these people. The hotel security decides that they don't want him at the hotel anymore. So when Todd Mueller's at the desk, like trying to do something or stay longer, the desk clerk says, oh, we can't. We have a big convention coming in and that whole floor is booked. The whole hotel is booked. And he's like, I've been here for weeks. And he's like, sorry, it's overbooked. So Todd just gets on the payphone, calls the hotel's toll-free reservation line, and books a room across the hall from where he was staying because he knew they were lying.
I love that, though. That I'm not mad at. Like, that's very funny.
Yeah, it's funny. He's persistent. Mm-hmm. And so then the hotel's employees checked his other room that he'd been staying in, and he had not cleaned it up, and they found several forged checks. And they also discovered that the phone in the hotel had made several calls to Honolulu. And one of the calls was to investigator Nobrega. So probably when he pretended to be the New York City police officer. So when Chicago police arrived to arrest him, oh, God. Instead, they unlock the door, open it, and Roy Hartsock is running to the door to open it. He doesn't have a shirt on. And they say, "Where is Todd Mueller?" And Hartsock says, "He's not here right now." He leans against the door jamb, takes his index finger, and starts rubbing it around his belly button.
Ew, what?
Yes!
I did not see any of that.
It so weird. Is so horrible.
What the fuck?
It can't be a direction he was given.
No.
I think the actor's just kind of a weirdo.
He made a choice as an actor.
Wow. He picked a character and he was going to stick to it.
This is who Roy Hartsock is.
This is who Roy is. He's a belly button twirler.
Mm-hmm. He's a rubber of the tum-tum.
No.
We have to post a video of this one, too. I'll get a video of this. It's horrible. Okay. So, as police are questioning Hartsock in the hotel room, Mueller comes out of the elevator and realizes that they're there, starts to turn around, and police chase and arrest him. So, Hartsock was returned to Hawaii to complete the rest of his sentence. Mueller was charged with forgery, fraud, and robbery. He was held at the Cook County Jail awaiting trial. 6 months later, he was taken to a hospital emergency room. Oh, he is so sharp, no pun intended.
He's slick.
Claiming that he had swallowed a razor blade. He's in the ER, he's handcuffed to his hospital bed, and a guard is watching him. But somehow, when that guard walked away for a little bit of time, he was able to escape. Slip his hand out of the handcuff or unlock it somehow. What they showed is that it was still hanging from the bed, but open.
Yeah.
But they didn't show how he did it.
Yeah.
And authorities did not know and don't know. So as of the airing of this, he had not been seen since escaping the hospital. However, after that, he did call Investigator Nobrega in Hawaii several times, claiming that he was going to turn himself in.
It's so funny. That was with Dr. Anderson. Remember the one that I covered?
Yes.
And like Catch Me If You, like Frank Abagnale?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Con men that are running so many scams, like, develop these relationships with the detectives pursuing
it's
them.
It's like part of it for them.
Yes. I find it so fascinating.
They're trolling. They're trolls.
Yeah.
So the last time he contacted Nobrega was on July 15th of 1991. At the time of the airing of this segment, he was wanted for a total of 40 felony counts. And not surprisingly, he has not remained in custody long enough to stand trial for any of them.
Oh my God.
Okay, so the reason why I said, is his name Todd Mueller, is because he was eventually captured in New Jersey. And he's captured in New Jersey under the alias Kenneth Maxwell. And he was arrested after he used a stolen embossing machine to fake American Express cards and gamble with them in Jersey, honey.
Oh my God.
That is the most Jersey crime.
So he was then placed
in. You can gamble with a credit card?
Yeah.
I think if you just have it on file with the casino.
That seems like a big problem.
You put up your card and borrow against it. They get your credit limit and then they know how much they can give you.
Oof.
Atlantic City, baby.
Oof. So then he was placed in a New York jail to await trial. FBI agents recognized him from UM.
Oh, neat.
Which is exciting. And positively identified Kenneth Maxwell as Mueller. But when he was in custody this fifth time, or whatever this is, it was discovered that Todd Mueller's real name is actually David Livingston. He's not Todd Mueller.
Oh, my God.
So many IDs, so many names.
So many. So while awaiting trial on the New Jersey fraud charges, he impersonated an assistant United States attorney and tried to escape from federal custody.
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
He was not successful, but he tried. Then, in October of 92, he pled guilty to the New Jersey charges and was sentenced to 18 months in prison. In July of 93, he pled guilty to charges of attempted escape and impersonation of a federal officer. He was sentenced to 3 years for that. Then he was sentenced to 11 years for his other crimes. And this says he served time and was released from prison in 1999. However, in his time in prison, he was not done conning. Of course, he can't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop.
He will not
stop. If he finds a gullible friend.
Oh, he's got to run that scam. It's what keeps him going.
So this is from a New York Post article, so take it with a grain of salt, you know. But
what are you trying to say?
But now we know him as Livingston, who this article describes as a notorious flim-flam artist who has orchestrated jailbreaks from here to Honolulu, is now behind bars in New York after being arraigned in Manhattan federal court for what prosecutors say was an ambitious scam, even by his high standards. This article is from the year 2000.
Okay.
He tricked a Japanese businessman out of $40,000 from a payphone at Rikers.
Oh my God. But wouldn't it have to say, like, do you accept this call?
This is how. He conned the Japanese businessman into believing that the businessman's associate, who was a Tiffany glass expert named Alistair Duncan, had been rearrested for violating bail.
Okay.
And he's calling to say he needs money to get bailed out. He was able to do this because he had Alistair Duncan's real paperwork, so he could get numbers of his friends and associates, call them, say, hey, your buddy's back in jail. He needs you to post bail for him.
Oh my God.
So then he finds letters that Alistair Duncan, that his friends had sent to a judge asking for leniency for Alistair Duncan. So then he starts calling them, claiming to be a lawyer named Arnold Striggles, and gets them to give him money.
Jeez.
For their friend.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
But everything fell apart when he called a rich friend of Alistair Duncan's who lives on the Upper East Side, and she became suspicious and called Duncan to check out the story. Then Duncan hired a private eye to turn the tables on Livingston.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Whoa. There's just a lot going on.
This is cinematic.
Yes. And the lawyer, Striggles, was using a British accent when he was the lawyer.
Mr. Striggles sounds like a cat.
Yep. Yeah, in like a cozy mystery. Mm-hmm. And there are so many things. It says he claimed to have put up his own, as Striggles, he claimed to have put up his own house toward the new $250,000 bail requirement, but was still $20,000 short and needed her to wire the difference over.
Whoa.
And there is a tape recorded phone call of this, and the woman says, oh, geez, oh, this is so terrible. But she's playing along because she knew at this point that he was faking it.
Oh, my God. Do we know who this woman was? It'd be great to know.
It doesn't. She's not named, sadly.
I wonder who she was.
Oh, my gosh. So the private investigator that Alistair Duncan hired says he cons his way into jail, he cons his way out of jail, he cons while he's in jail. That's how he gets his jollies. Oh, I hate that term.
Never not conning. What a flim-flammer.
He's a flim-flammer. So, I mean, there are, like, I have court documents here that list, like, every little thing he did, every date. It's, like, four pages long.
Oh, my God.
It would take a long time to read. But from what I've read, it says he was released from federal custody in July of 2015 after doing all these extra things.
Okay.
And I couldn't find where he is now, probably because he does not want to be found. And why would I be able to find him?
He's got a million names. Where do we?
Yeah. Impossible. Jeez. So that is the Connie Khan story of Todd Mueller, aka his real name, David Livingston.
David Flim Flam Livingston.
Which it's so funny because in the update screen, it reads his real name was Todd Mueller, but that wasn't even his real name.
Oh my God.
You
It was Mr. Striggles.
Of course. So that's it.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Wow.
That was a ride. Yep. That was fun.
Hey guys, it's Carlin. When I'm not listening to true crime, I do love to get down on a good beauty podcast or beauty YouTube show, but it's really hard to find a guru that's relatable and that I can actually learn something from. But I found this podcast called Beauty Uncovered, and basically each episode is just a casual interview with an expert in a certain area, whether that be beauty, health, wellness, or lifestyle. And I just find it really informative, and it's stuff you can actually apply to your real life, which I think is really cool. So subscribe now to the Beauty Uncovered podcast on Apple Pods or wherever you get your podcasts and get your weekly guide to uncovering your beauty.
All right. The last segment of season 4, episode 13 is a lost love segment. And it begins with Stack telling us that James and Wanda Vess were married in 1956. 17 years later, they had 9 children, 6 sons and 3 daughters. The oldest child was 16 and the youngest was just 10 months.
No.
That's actually what happens when I die and go to hell. I don't have any children. James worked in the construction business, and for the Vess children, life at home seemed safe and secure. Shireen Vess Davis says that they would have dinner every night at the table. She says that her mother would have everything done by the time her father got home from work. She says that her mother sat at one end of the table, her father sat at the other, and the children sat on the side. She said that they had an ideal life. They would go to church on Sunday. They would sing for the church with their mother because their mother played the accordion. And they would sing at home together. Shireen says that they would have fun. She says it was a typical American family life like you would see on Leave It to Beaver.
This takes quite the turn, though.
Okay, so that's what she says. And next we see a reenactment of all 9 of the children at a funeral service. It's a real, it's a twist. So Stack says that in May of 1974, the Vess family was ripped apart by tragedy. Wanda Vess had died on her 34th birthday. Shireen Vess Davis says that she felt cheated. And Stack says that James Vess did not attend the funeral because he was in jail, charged with the murder of his wife. Buried the lead on that one. I thought we were just looking for one kid.
But yes. Here we are.
So Stack asks, what would bring a man to kill his own wife and leave his children as orphans? The answer might be hauntingly simple. James Ness was an alcoholic. The 9 Ness children lost their parents due to this disease, and they also lost each other for 17 years. He says this is a story of one woman's determination to find her siblings and one family's resilience in the face of overwhelming tragedy. I do think it's nice that he said disease.
Yeah.
Yeah, and totally.
Pretty forward thinking for 1990.
Yes.
Agree.
By 1973, years of drinking binges had steadily eroded James and Wanda Vess's marriage. James was often too drunk to work and became increasingly violent to his wife. Shireen says that she remembers on one occasion when her father came home looking for his bottle of liquor, and her mother had hidden it so he couldn't find it. She says he got really upset, and he wanted his liquor, but she wouldn't give it to him, so he started beating Wanda up.
Yeah, that scene was terrible.
Yeah. She says he was on her and choking her, so Shireen's brothers had to get her dad off of her mother. And then, this is a heartbreaker, Shireen says that she was always more quiet and afraid. And it's like, yeah, girl.
Yeah.
Yes. You weren't your 16-year-old brother. You were just a 13-year-old girl, and your father was choking your mom.
Yes.
Of course you were quiet and afraid.
Yes.
Stack says that Wanda Vess had finally had enough. She threw James out of the house and filed for divorce. She was determined to make a new life for herself and her 9 children, but with no formal training and little work experience, Wanda was forced to wait tables and tend bar in a local tavern. And Stack says that sentence, like, being in the restaurant industry is the worst job in the world. He's like, you guys, this was
look
all
what
she
had
could
to do.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, nobody wants to do that job now, but...
On May 27th, 1974, at around 1 a.m., James Vess went to the bar where Wanda was working. It was her 34th birthday. According to witnesses, James had been drinking heavily. In the reenactment, James tells Wanda he wants to buy her a drink for her birthday. He's like, let me buy a drink for your birthday. Happy birthday, baby. And she's basically like, what are you doing here? Like, get the fuck out.
Yep.
And she throws James out of the bar. He leaves and then, I think, pretty much immediately comes back with a shotgun. He screams for everyone in the bar because the bar has people in it. Mm-hmm. There are people at the bar.
Yeah.
He screams for everyone to get out of the bar. And then he shoots Wanda. Mm-hmm. He shoots her once from a distance, then climbs his little body up onto the bar, leans over, and shoots her again. And while he does, he says, I love you, Wanda.
Ugh.
Hate it.
Approximately an hour later, James Vess was arrested at a nearby tavern. Because minutes after killing Wanda, James had swaggered into the bar, boasting that he had just shot his wife and he needed a drink.
And also, everyone in the bar saw him before they left.
They didn't leave. They didn't leave.
Oh, they just got down?
They moved out toward the door. Some of them left, but some of them were still in the bar, like up against the wall.
So they actually saw it.
They saw the whole thing. They saw the whole thing. And that's why, because I was like, are they being dramatic? Like, he shoots her, he climbs on the bar, shoots her again, and says, I love you, Wanda. Like, is that just drama?
Yeah.
It was not. There are witness statements.
Someone saw that. Wow.
So Vess later pled guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison, where he died in 1983. In one senseless and violent moment, James Vess had shattered his entire family.
Just leave. Just leave.
Just leave.
Leave them all.
Within days of Wanda's funeral, the Vess children were sent to live in separate homes. And this is, I mean, everything about this is heartbreaking. But it's really sad. Shireen says, for some reason, she thought that they had enough family that the children wouldn't be separated, that someone would take them in. She says, though, that she was wrong because it was like no one wanted them because they were taboo. To be around her and her siblings would mean that people would have to accept what had happened, and they didn't want to do that. And I think she means that people would have to accept that they knew that there was violence happening in the home, but they didn't do anything to help Wanda.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think that's what she means.
That is
they
true.
Don't want to look at these children and relive the guilt that they feel for not getting involved and helping to save Wanda.
Yep.
To Shireen, the children were punished for what their father did because they weren't even allowed to have each other. And I hate everything about this story besides Shireen and Wanda. It's so upsetting. Stack says the oldest son, James Jr., was taken in by his grandmother. Shireen and 3 brothers, Russell, Kenneth, and Wayne, were placed in foster homes. Her sister Kendra and the 3 youngest children, Heath, Don, and Kevin, were put up for adoption. It gets worse. For 14-year-old Shireen, the tragic loss of her entire family marked the beginning of a cycle of despair. Just 3 months after her mother was murdered, Shireen ran away from her foster home and began living on the streets. Shireen says that she would sleep in the hallways of apartment buildings, and a couple of times she slept outside. Mm. She says it was cold and she was scared. She had a backpack with some clothes in it that she used for a pillow. She says, quote, you lay there and halfway sleep and hope that no one comes around. 14.
No.
Stack says that remarkably, Shireen managed to escape the streets. Eventually, she enrolled in business school and later got a job as an office manager. As of this airing, Shireen lives in San Diego with her husband and her 2 daughters. Sack says 4 years ago, with the loving encouragement of her family, Shireen began looking for her brothers and sisters, whom she had not seen. This says 11 years, but I think it was longer than 11 years. Incredibly, it took Shireen less than 2 months to find 4 of her brothers. Mm. 2 years later, she was reunited with her eldest sister. And just last Christmas, Shireen finally made contact with her youngest sister and brother. But one of the Vest children still remains unaccounted for. Shireen's brother Heath, who was just 6 years old when the family was separated. Shireen says that she isn't going to take no for an answer. And she knows that she will find him and she will get all of the siblings together. And yeah, she will, because she managed to find the first 7 children in like 4 years.
Yeah, she's amazing. I was like,
she doesn't even need this show. She's
Seriously, she's doing it.
She's a queen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stack then says the night of the broadcast, Shireen's dream of finding her brother came true when he called the telecenter. Heath was now married and living in Ohio. He was shocked to learn that he'd been featured on national television. The next day, Heath spoke with his sister for the first time in 17 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know why they said 11. It was 17 years.
Yeah.
4 weeks later, Heath, accompanied by his wife Robin, arrived in Los Angeles for a special reunion with 5 of his brothers and sisters. Nice. I believe at this point, after doing research, the people at the reunion were Don, Kendra, Russell, I think Kevin, and then Shireen. Heath said that he was really excited getting out of the car, and he's so cute. Mm. He said that he was wondering who he was going to hug first, and he didn't want anyone to, quote, start bawling or anything. He says he wanted to hug everyone at once. Shireen says that she thought it would take months to find Heath. She didn't think that he would just call in and it would be that easy. Mm. Heath says that meeting everyone has picked up his attitude because he had a lot of feelings that he was unwanted and he didn't know why. But now that they've found him, he has a wanted feeling. He said it's a good feeling and he never really knew.
Oh, she's a honey.
He is a honey.
Shireen says that finding Heath and this reunion is the first day and it feels like a new beginning. She says that she knows that when they all leave from the reunion, they will all leave, quote, differently, and it will be good for all of them. Mm-hmm. And it is the nicest thing. So here's my little mini update. There's not a lot to add because Shireen is such a badass. She basically solved the mystery her damn self. Mm-hmm. I tried to find some more information on Wanda Vass, but her murder was truly given 3 sentences on the 4th page of a local newspaper.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Her obituary said that she had only been employed at the bar for 2 weeks before James murdered her. And this is a quote from the police report. Mr. Vass left. He came back with a shotgun, witnesses told police, fired 1 shot at Mrs. Vass, who was behind the bar, then reloaded his single shotgun and fired again. As we know, the threat of death is at its highest when a victim of domestic violence tries to leave their partner. Mm-hmm. Anywhere between 50 and 75% of domestic violence homicides happen at the point of separation or after the victim has already left their abuser. According to a 2014 Guardian article, about 1 in 4 women will at one point in their lives be beaten or abused by someone they know. Each year, about 4,000 women die because of domestic violence. Mm. To be perfectly clear, alcohol and alcoholism are never a sole trigger for or the cause of domestic abuse. Rather, they are compounding factors that could eventually trigger intimate partner abuse in a violent individual. 2/3 of victims of spousal abuse report that the perpetrator had been drinking at the time of the incident. This doesn't just apply to the U.S. Global studies show higher odds of domestic abuse if one or both partners are dependent on alcohol. Mm. The World Health Organization estimates that roughly 55% of domestic abuse perpetrators were drinking alcohol prior to the assault. Women who are abused are 15 times more likely to abuse alcohol. And specific to us, 68% of the delinquent youths in Oregon treatment programs had witnessed their mother's abuse or been abused themselves. Mm. So I just wanted to give some stats because I like to put those in every once in a while when we have a segment about domestic abuse and domestic violence and how it affects not only the partner but also the children of the couple. So everyone is wondering if the family stays in contact in these segments, and I am so excited that most of them do.
Aww.
Off the bat, I want to say that some of the members of the family had some run-ins with the law in the 90s and the early aughts. Forgery, burglary, manufacture of controlled substance, DUIs, drug possessions. It's been mentioned on sitcoms online, and people have found it out. I found it out. So I don't want to exclude the information.
Yeah.
But I want to point out that we have to give some grace to these people who survive this kind of childhood trauma.
They've been through a lot of trauma.
Exactly. So that's all I'm going to say about it because I really want to focus on how awesome these siblings are and how awesome this family is. So the eldest son, James, is living in Texas. I don't think he's on social media, or if he is, he isn't in contact with his other siblings.
Okay.
I do think it's interesting that Stack said that he went to go live with his grandmother and not their grandmother. So, I mean, he was firmly separated from the rest of the group. So Shireen now lives in the Tampa, Florida area, along with Wayne, Don, Heath, and Kevin.
Heath too, yay!
It seems like Don, Kevin, and Wayne are very close. They spend a ton of time together. I think Russell lives in Oklahoma, but I did find pictures of them hanging out on the beach in Florida. Sadly, Kenneth died in 1996 at the age of 34, which was the same age as Wanda. Yeah. I couldn't figure it out how he passed away. And then Kendra died in 2014 at the age of 48 after a long battle with cancer. So for the first time ever, this is a visual update. So I'm going to post collage photos of this family. They're going to be on our website. I'll give some to Carlin to put on Instagram. But it is so nice to see these siblings in the same photos. They're smiling. They're having a great time. So these are public social media accounts. I didn't have to like do anything gnarly to find them. But it is so much fun. The photos of them are on at holidays, like Thanksgiving. They went to on vacation to Hawaii. They're at parties. They seem like they have some awesome parties. I saw one photo and it was captioned right before Wayne jumped off the roof. Like like they are lit and fun. They're so great. I want to hang out with them and be their friend.
Update. The family is lit.
Update. The family is awesome. Kevin is a tattoo artist and he gave Don a tattoo.
Oh, yes. Cute.
And he also has a he created a tattoo for himself in honor of Kendra, which is how I found out that Kendra passed away. They're just always on the beaches of Florida, and they're like tan and smiling. It's so wonderful. So if you want to see the actual update to this segment and see some photos of this amazing family who persevered through so much and are still so close, even though they have no right to be and maybe would have never found each other if it wasn't for Shireen, I'm going to post everything on our website, so you have to go check it out.
I love it.
And that's it. It was truly one of my favorite Lost Love segments ever.
Yeah, it's so nice.
They have so much love for each other.
That's as happy of an ending as they could have had.
Yeah. Yes, truly. And it is sad. Kendra was very close with them before she passed away.
Aww.
I wasn't able to find anything about Kenneth because it was so long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to think, like, these families, four of them were adopted out.
Yeah.
Right.
And they still came back together.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Aww, it's great.
Yay, good job.
Thanks. Yay, that's family.
Shireen's a queen.
She is amazing. Yeah.
Shireen the queen.
I love the holidays. I love everything about them. But one of my favorite things is buying gifts for the people that I care about. Recently, I discovered Elfster. Elfster is the number one secret Santa app in the world. With Elfster, you can create a free gift exchange to make gift giving easier. You just set the time and the budget, and Elfster takes care of the rest. They even draw the names for you. You can create a virtual gift exchange, and it's an amazing way to bring friends and family together near and far, no matter where they are in the world. The coolest part is that you and your loved ones can add gifts to personal wish lists from all the brands that you love, including Amazon, Etsy, Fanatics, Nordstrom, Sephora, and Zappos. You can make multiple wish lists and then share them with different gift exchange groups. For example, if you have a Secret Santa with your coworkers for a lower dollar amount than, say, your friends and family or even your significant other. And if you're trying to figure out what you'd like for the holidays, you can choose from Elfster's curated gift guides and get some goodies. So join the over 17 million people who use Elfster for their holiday gift giving and go to elfster.com, E-L-F-S-T-E-R.com, or download the app today.
Okay, we did it. Things to share? Anything you've been enjoying?
Me.
Go.
I've been watching so much good TV lately.
Well, and I was just telling Eliza while you were out of the room before that we are watching all the same TV right now.
Oh my God. So that's great. We've got some shared chairsies. I love a shared chairsie. So Ted Lasso is back for second season. I don't know if you guys watched that.
Sure do.
It's amazing. I love it. It is such a feel-good show that I don't know how to watch it because every time I think there's a conflict, I say to my partner, oh no, and then he says, it's not that kind of show.
No. But I will say, I made the comment last night that I appreciate they can get into some like really serious like mental health stuff and stuff like that, but still have like a feel-good element to everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just not like heavy and dark, but it's also not like frivolous and stupid.
So yeah, totally.
It's really good. Everybody in it's amazing. Yeah, so I'm sure that everybody that listens to our podcast is probably already watching it. I know that it's wildly
popular. And we've
talked
about it before too.
Yeah, but definitely watch the second season. It's so good.
Yeah, it's really good.
It is LOL funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that yours too, Carla?
Well, that and even though by time this comes out, I'll be... But I'm getting excited to go see some family we haven't seen in about 2 years because of COVID.
Yay.
So yeah, we're gonna, I mean, even though things are not great right now, at least we're vaccinated and we're gonna be as safe as we possibly can. And all our family is vaccinated and we're gonna travel to see some fam in both New Hampshire and South Carolina. And I'm really excited to see them.
Yeah, East Coast, nice. Baby.
The last time I saw my oldest niece, she was like a little kiddo to me. And now she has braces. She's wearing a bra. She's like probably as tall as me. It's so wild.
Gosh.
Yeah. So it'll be really good to see them.
That's so good.
That's awesome. I'm glad you guys are getting to go.
Me too.
Yeah. Mine is another podcast. Mm-hmm. And this one is one of my very favorite podcast series I've ever listened to in my whole life.
Wow.
That is saying a lot for you.
It is saying so much. And it is called The Grand Scheme Snatching Sinatra.
Oh.
I've seen ads for that.
So good.
Wow.
You have to listen.
Okay.
Hosted by John Stamos.
Oh,
and
what?
Does an incredible job.
That. Yeah.
I do love
and
Uncle Jesse.
It is the first person account of the man who kidnapped Frank Sinatra Jr. for ransom money.
Holy moly.
Just everything he was going through at the time. Oh my gosh, it is so good. I'm going to re-listen to it because I loved it so much.
Wow. So. Okay.
It's great.
All right, I'm down.
You gotta. You'll love it.
Awesome.
Okay. Do we have a review?
We do.
Because a sweetie reviewed us.
We do. Yeah. We do.
So this is written by Might Have a Problem, and I'm with you. And it says, thanks for enabling me. I'm on my third journey through Unsolved Mysteries. I was super excited to find a podcast that I might be almost as obsessed with UM as I am. Mm-hmm. Plus, the three hosts are intelligent, well-educated, progressive, and hilarious. Their true hatred of violence and wrongdoing burns through the episodes, mm-hmm. as does their empathy and respect for those wronged. As a mid-century modern-aged woman living in a red state, it is super reassuring to hear their voices. Now every week.
Aww. Oh,
so nice, honey.
Thank you so much, honey.
Very nice. Little sweetie.
Too many compliments, honestly.
Okay, next episode is season 4, episode 14. I'm talking about the final appeal of Larry Race.
Ooh, I think that's only like our second or third final appeal.
Yeah.
And then we've got an unexplained death about Jean Tovrea.
And then I have the last love segment of Helen Rose.
Okay, everybody, go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. If you subscribe there at the $5 a month level or higher, you'll get some bonus things, some ad-free episodes, some goodies in the mail, all kinds of fun things to see photos that we reference in the episode. Follow us on Instagram at Resolved Mysteries Podcast, on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005 Portland, Oregon, 97293. And subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a 5-star review. Tell 2 friends. Allison is up in the ante over here.
2 friends this week.
And for every review that we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization. And this month's organization is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
All right.
All right. We love you.
We love you so.
We do.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Carlin, take it away.
1, 2, 3.
Wow.
Good on your side?
This is good.
Amazing.
Good on mine, too.
Not great on mine. Okay.
Cruella DeVille. She's so mean to us with the clapping.
I'm not mean. You're harassing me with your terrible claps.
With our delay.
Okay.